said, Grandpa, what's this picture here? It's all black and white. It ain't real clear, is that you there? He said, yeah, I was 11. Time for tough, back in 35. That's me and Uncle Joe just trying to survive a cotton farm and a Great Depression. If it looks like we were scared to death, like a couple of kids just trying to save each other, you should have seen it in color. On this one here, taken overseas in the middle of hell in 1943, in the wintertime. Almost see my breath. That was my tail gunner, old Johnny McGee. He was a high school teacher from New Orleans, and he had my back right through the day we left. If it looked like we were scared to death, like a couple of kids just trying to save each other, you should have seen it in color. A picture's worth a thousand words, but you can't see what those shades of gray can cover. You should have seen it in color. This one is my favorite one. This is me and Grandma in the summer sun, all dressed up the day we said our vows. You can't tell here, but it was hot that June. That rose is red and her eyes were blue. And just look at that smile, I was so proud. That's the story of mine, right there in black and white. And it looked like we were scared to death, like a couple of kids just trying to save each other. You should have seen it in color. But you can't see what those shades of gray keep covering. You should have seen it in color.
Hello, boys and girls. It's Terrible Tommy back in the bunker today, and today is, what is it? September the 27th, 2016. September's almost over, and we got the cool breezes back here in Indiana now. We went down to 50 and a little below last night. So the corn changed overnight almost, and 2 days, the corn went from green to yellow, ready to pick. How about that? The only trouble is we use too much corn in our diet, and too much corn is being sprinkled with all this toxic stuff. What do they call it? Yeah, Roundup, and that's scary. So watch this corn consumption stuff. Of course, everywhere you look here in Indiana, it's corn, corn, corn. We got a lot of corny people, too, I'll tell you that. Well, I swore I wasn't going to watch the debate last night. Then I said, well, I'll watch a half an hour of it. And then I ended up watching an hour and a half before I quit in disgust. because Trump, he may be a good builder, and he may be a big contractor, may be very successful, but in debating, he leaves a lot to be required. It reminds me of a boxer. I remember a boxer back that was big back in the 50s, I believe it was, or 60s, Chuck Davies. And he was a real good man on his feet. He really moved around, and that's what a boxer needs to do. Yeah. And he also was a hard puncher. Well, what we got here with Trump is, instead of going to the body and body punching all the way, forget about the head, just punch the body. He fell for the bait that any high school debater would not fall for. She kept attacking his personal life, and he kept going crazy and trying to defend it. And she was loving it. All he had to do was, is that so? A little zen. Is that so? A smile and attack her. She's got a million things to attack about. He don't need to defend himself, and he shouldn't defend himself. That's a real bad way to debate. And even Ronald Reagan, remember when he was debating, who was it, Jimmy Carter? And he'd say, well, there you go again, and just smile and go on and counterattack. I've been on TV shows from one coast to the other for many years, and I didn't sit around defending myself all the time. Of course, I defended myself some of the time, but I counterattack. I go after them. That's how I turned the blacks on at the Apollo Theater in New York City on the Jews. Yeah, they wanted me to defend myself. The rabbi kept wanting me to defend myself. And I came out counterattacked and asked about him being a big Israel supporter and supplying weapons to South Africa. Israel building all these weapons for South Africa. So that was an interesting thing. I turned the whole crowd against him in one paragraph or so. And that's what Trump's got to learn to do. Forget all those attacks that she makes on him. She played it beautifully. And he fell for it every time. Like I say, just use the old Zen response. Is that so? Smile and attack her on one of her bad points. And he'd have done really good. But he did not do good. She was at the top of her choice there, top of her game, and he fell right into the trap. And if he does that in another two debates, he's definitely going to lose by a lot. Now, I say he's going to lose anyhow, no matter how many votes he gets, because the Electoral College, a lot of you people don't know, that the electors in the Electoral College are not bound by anything. They're not bound by party. They're not bound by anything. And so they can decide whatever they want. And they all have their alliances and loyalties to whoever. And so he can get all kinds of popular vote like Gore did, and Bush turned around and beat him. They get him at the Electoral College. I mean, even if Trump had twice the votes of Hillary, she still can win. I hope people get that through their head. That was a method that the ruling class used in the old days and still does as a stopgap thing to stop any interloper that was trying to move in, and they didn't want him. They didn't want him, so they're not going to get past the Electoral College. Oh, man, I sit there gritting my teeth. Any prize fighter knows Go for the body punch, body punch, body punch. Don't worry too much about going for that headshot, that one headshot that you think's going to knock him out. You got to just keep pounding away at the midsection. And you can win. But either that or be like Rocky Marciano, where they could stand there and beat him beat him half to death all night, and he still wouldn't fall down. But that's a hard way to make a living. Hard way to make a living. Trump is extremely sensitive to anything that has to do with his business or his family. And I understand that. He's a natural man. I feel the same way. But that's not the way you win against these assholes like Hillary Clinton. It's just not the way to beat him. I wish he would listen to someone like me once in a while. But that's not going to happen because he's not listening to other people that are telling him the same thing. There's other people telling him the same thing. But he turns around every time and takes victory out of the mouth of defeat out of the mouth of victory. Well, anyhow, why do we get excited about this? Worse is better. She's so bad that it's better for us if she gets in. Yeah. And the system don't like to hear that. No, they want to see us all run around like the right wing and Duke and all these people trying to push guys like Trump. We're not going to do hardly anything that we want anyhow once they get in, if they get in. So we're better off just to say worse is better and vote for Hillary. You know, that drives them crazy. I heard a guy say on the radio this morning that racists can't stand being called racist. You know, that's true. You know, almost all the whites who are definitely racist, when they're called a racist, will deny it. Well, until you can accept the fact that you are a racist and say, yes, I am a racist, I'm proud to be a racist, I'll be a racist forever until I die and probably even beyond. But how many people have you heard that? You know, I've heard thousands of white people on TV and radio and everything that are obviously, I've even heard Ku Klux Klan people say, I'm not a racist. I mean, you know, you look like a fool, you look like a coward, you look like an idiot. So I've made it a practice for decades, say, yes, I'm a white racist and I'm proud of it. Aren't you? Why aren't you? Anyhow, if old Donald doesn't change his ways of debating, forget the next two debates. It'll be he'll fall into the same trap and forget it. Because I can't stand there and look at this, or sit there in my easy chair and look at this Hillary. It just drives me crazy. I just want to reach through the screen and punch her in the mouth. Because you know what a goddamn crook and liar she is. Of course, they're all certain amount. All of them are crooks. You can't get to that high on the hog running for office without being at least partial crook. There's no way. You can't maintain your honesty and become a high-power politician. It can't be done, even when you're promising everything to everybody. And you can't promise everything to anybody. You know, Trump was promising to have this child bill that would help the young people out. And he said it would be paid for by wiping out corruption. You're not going to pay for it by wiping out corruption. It's not possible. Now, if he'd have said, this is a good law, good bill that we're going to pass, and it's going to cost us some money, but it's a good thing, that'd be fine. But why lie when he knows that they don't have the money to do it? But he promised the people. Now, that's just like the progressive. That's just like Hillary. He was just trying to do the same goddamn thing Hillary's doing. Promising something and saying it's not going to cost any money. In fact, most of the time she does say it's going to cost us money. But here's a Republican promising, well, we're going to do all this stuff. It's worth billions of dollars, but it ain't going to cost you no money. because we'll take it from here and put it over there and all that stuff. Anyhow, there's nothing lower than a white politician. Nothing lower than a white politician, because politician is corruption. It's corruption all the way. You know, it's not going to change. A real leader will not do it by the political system. A real leader, the real leaders in the world have never done it by just politicking. Another point that Trump failed to hit her with, every time she yapped about his businesses and how he went bankrupt and all this kind of stuff, he should have responded and said, "What job have you ever had? What gainful employment have you had in 40 years? You had your nose in a goddamn trough all your life. You've never had to make your living the hard way. So don't ever point your finger at me, Hillary. You've been a leech on the public trough all your life." Yeah, so that's how I'd handle that. Of course, what we would like to hear is a politician that when she attacked Donald and his father for keeping the blacks out of all the rental apartments in these boroughs in New York, which other companies did the same thing. Everybody did the same thing almost back then. He should say, "Hell yes, I did it, and I'll do it again if I get a chance." You know, of course, that's political suicide, but the only way we'll ever change things is to be honest and come out with it and fight for it. That's what made me turn me into a racist, is when they passed the Rumford Fair Housing Bill in California. When they said that I had to if I wanted to sell my house, I had to sell it to anyone who come to the front door. That's when they lost me. That's when I crossed the line and became a racist. Because then you have no freedom, no liberty, no control over the mainstay, your house or your business or anything like that. If you can't discriminate, you're a slave. Only slaves can't discriminate. I'm going to read a little James Mason. It always gives me a thrill to read out of this book, Siege, because he put it right on the line. He always did. Here's a quote. "In your living room, you're scared shitless, and that's just where the power structure wants you. In the middle of a riot, I've never found anybody who's chicken shit. The way to eliminate fear is to do what you're most afraid of." That was Jerry Rubin, the Jew. Remember him? "The abscess on the sick body of a nation must be cut open and squeezed until clear red blood flows. And the blood must be left to flow for a good long time till the body is purified." That was Captain Gerhard Rosbach, Berlin, SA. "This dream of absolute universal equality is amazing, terrifying, and inhuman. And the moment it captures people's minds, the result is mountains of corpses and rivers of blood." That was Vladimir Bukovsky. "What is legal? Legal is anything that the system does. Legal is whatever the system allows to happen. Illegal is whatever the system does not allow others outside the cloned system to do. The system is legal. Therefore, legal is simply the system." Edward Reynolds. "The way times have changed." Now remember, this book was written back in the 70s. "I can't think of a more stark example of the way things have turned around just within the past 20 years in this country than something uttered by Gus Hall in 61. He said, "I dream of the hour when the last congressman is strangled to death on the guts of the last preacher." The right wing went crazy over that one and used it as part of their heavy ammunition against the Communist Party. Well, old Gus has shelved that rather embarrassing statement. I don't find that statement embarrassing. I really don't. because it's got a hell of a lot of truth to it. Not because he is getting soft in his old age, hardly, but rather because it's about as outdated as high-button shoes. In those days, he may have had some basis for a statement like that, because conservatism and the former concept of America, as it was known, was making its last stand against the total subversion that today holds all the seats of open power. Today's congressmen and preachers are truly among Gus Hall's best troop. Why, he wouldn't want to harm a hair on their heads. Gus and his buddies have it all. The Congress and the clergy are two arms on the body of Big Brother. Conservatism lost, while the forces that Gus Hall was running with won out. And now the shoe is on the other foot. Masters of subtlety, they've everything except the signs posted on the walls to effect that Big Brother rules completely. But our movement has no corner on profits. The words of Gus Hall too will ring true yet in the United States, but they will do so in such a manner, with such an ironic twist, that he and all his fellow travelers will choke on them. It remains altogether impossible to refrain from encountering conservative sentiments, reactions, and other modes of thought and behavior. There remain great numbers of those short-sighted ones who feel that the situation can be and should be cleaned up. The fact is that this kind of thinking plays directly into the hands of Big Brother's lackeys who are trying desperately to hold our system together as long as possible, to suck as much blood as they can out of the dwindling numbers of productive Americans before it all finally goes to hell. The answers they propose, or the totally insane and out-of-control crime rate, are number one, build more prisons, but mainly number two, the death penalty, fry 'em, says the reactionaries. They envision the ghetto criminals and rapists and so on going straight to the hot seat, but that is a dangerous delusion. Few are aware that one of the first men to die as a result of the renewal of the death penalty was John Spinkelink of Florida, who was a white man, a National Socialist, whose crime was having killed a homosexual who had made advances on his person. There is a case of a National Socialist who voted in a state election for an issue to deny bond for certain violent crimes, only to be arrested himself and charged with just such a crime. And since the issue passed denied bond, what of Joseph Paul Franklin and any of the men who followed in his heroic footsteps, who maybe one day faced the system's death by injection? You must remember the system is going to do nothing to fight crime, but only to increase the degree of its hold over every individual. It created the crime wave in the first place as an excuse and a plausible cover for the erection of its police state. And if it can again use the issue of rampant crime to get you to agree to the death penalty, only turn around right around and use it on you and other white revolutionaries. We want to see crime and chaos rise to such a degree where the system becomes no longer viable and falls apart. We want to see them lose control, not increase it. We want to hasten the death of the system, not postpone it. The liberal do-gooders, so hated by conservative advocates of the death penalty, saved the life of Charles Manson and those of his circle who had been condemned to die in California's gas chamber after the conservative Nixon had declared them guilty in the national headlines. What of such favorite conservative issues as universal military service? They want a strong U.S. military, but they are so ignorant of history that they are unaware that the U.S. has never been allowed to fight and defeat an enemy, but only to go and kill other white men, such as the Civil War, the First World War, the Second World Wars. They appear perfectly happy to go to fight another war and save alien interests. Besides, if you're a young white man or woman, do you wish to be drafted into any of the services alongside the dregs of society and under black officers, possibly to be sent to die in fabricated wars, possibly to be sent a la Little Rock to violently suppress your own white brothers and sisters? No, let the military continue to crumble as it is doing, for it is merely one more instrument of terror and coercion in the hands of the enemy. See, Donald Trump wants a big, strong military. He wants bigger and bigger military. He did mention something about bringing troops back from these various countries, but that's bullshit. He's not going to do it, even if he was president. They can tell you anything in a campaign for president or anything else, but you know, no matter who it is, once they get in, most of the time they don't do what they say. What other reactionary favorites can we choose from? Drugs, abortion, gun control? If we're unable to recruit for our own positive purposes from the populace and get them to drop out of service to the system, then we must accept whatever means there may be to cause more and more of them to fall by the wayside and become useless to Big Brother. The spread of the use of drugs is one of these methods. Increase in abortion is a major symptom of a total collapse of American morality, which is one of the pillars of any society. As long as the alien is in control of society, let it perish also. If the cowardly reactionaries can fool themselves into believing that they are free by possessing firearms but lacking the guts to use them, then it would be heartwarming to watch the system pigs strip them of these. Make no mistake, under our society, our laws, crime would be eradicated overnight. Likewise, with the illicit use of drugs and unnatural tens such as an abortion, every man and woman would be military trained. Every home in America would be well stocked with defense weapons. But this would only be in our society, never theirs. When I was a kid in junior high, I had one science instructor whom I genuinely admired and respected. He even took my side in crowded corridors when I was verbally assailed by typical smartasses who would attack my totalitarian beliefs by agreeing with me that democracy and voting were a farce, and so on. One theory of his own creation that he offered to the class, which made an instant and lingering impression on me, was that it required approximately 8 years for trends prevalent in places like New York, Chicago, Los Angeles to filter down to places like Chillicothe, Ohio. That was 18 years ago, and the theory hasn't missed yet. A worse sort of maladies of the big sinkholes of North America have since well established themselves here. All the horror headlines that used to be only printed in the doomsaying Thunderbolt, you now can read every day in the lone paper here in a small town in the Midwest. The worst of all, you name it, and it's here. And what does it mean? It means scientifically, irrefutably, that the country isn't going, but has gone mad, that the final end of society is accelerating, that the entire foundation itself is thoroughly corroded, and that there is no longer any place to go to hide, save maybe a tent in North Woods. Now, isn't that the most encouraging thing anyone has reported to you in a long time? Long time? Like a brown bag or a cardboard box full of manure held aloft with the bottom darkening and the saturation from all the slimy, stinky filth contained within. It is up for grabs. How many moments or seconds remain before the whole repulsive, putrefied mess comes crashing down? This may well be the first time ever in history that an entire people cannot sustain itself minus electricity and things to run it by. But it is not the first time that an entire people have been eaten away at its very roots and core, so that no healthy portion large enough remains to carry on with the semblance of a former civilization. It has happened often enough in the past, most notably in the case of ancient Rome. A great many Roman ruins still stand today, such as the aqueducts and the viaducts, and are in modern use. But nowhere, not even in the city of Rome, can one find a true Roman, a living specimen of the people who built the culture and the empire. We know it in the movement, what became of them, but how many can see the parallels as they are happening here today? As it occurred in history, the large Dark Ages followed the collapse of Rome, as a number of observers have been so far in this country history. The United States has not had a revolution, only a war of independence. It has not had a civil war, only a war between the states. Our true revolution and our true civil war are things of the future. They'll probably take place one on top of the other, and our own fall of Rome and Dark Ages will most likely overlap as well. Things are moving much faster nowadays. And now they're really moving fast. What's happening to the backbone of the U.S. population? All those millions upon millions of Anglo-Saxons has been squeezed plain operation from the close of the last century to the present day. Commander Rockwell talked of the niggerization of American youth, and he was right. But since he was forced to swim in a milieu of conservative rightists, he neglected mentioning that the other half of the assault that was just as deadly, that from above. 50 years ago, all the social ills that have this country by the throat today were confined to two limited areas: the colored ghettos and from the circles of filthy rich. These people who today are indulging in or are trapped by the social cancer, from drugs to whatever you want to include, might imagine it as something new. It isn't. It's only relatively new to them. It requires several generations to do it, but finally their resistance was broken, and the walls were removed, and hell has risen. It is preferable to them, and it's referred to them as freedom, equality, progress, self-expression, alternate lifestyles, human rights, dignity, and so forth. I've said before that it has reached everywhere now, and indeed has stood at the point of saturation for some time. If there were ever to be a major input of clean and the fresh and the pure to hope to rejuvenate the situation, as in the case of Rome, it'll have to come from the outside, as with armies of invading barbarians that the integrating soul-rotted Roman legions couldn't resist. That points nowhere but the East. It can be happened before the rot of the West finally infects the East as well. But in the hopes of getting our own thinking balanced out, there ever have been a danger to our masses of racially sound people of being poisoned from above, unless they had already been rotted from above. Healthy people aren't susceptible to such things as drugs and racial mixing. It took a couple of generations of Hollywood's and New York's effects on their minds via movies, the newspapers, especially television, to get them properly softened up. In my book, there's really nothing more vile and detestable than a crowd of so-called beautiful people centered in Los Angeles, New York, all really fashionable resort spots. These are the types set up by the media to be worshipped and emulated by the masses. Take a look around at the results of 50 years of this, and just as final thought and exactly what a bunch of people was that were erased by a few hippies back on a hot night in 69, and for which Charles Manson now serves several terms of life imprisonment. While we were watching out below, Manson saw the threat from above. Among other things, I happen to be an amateur photographer, and I've been involved in the past few years in documenting the development and decline of this city where he lives. The town of Chillicothe, Ohio, was formerly not only the state capital, but also the capital of the entire Northwest Territory, which encompassed all of Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Wisconsin, and parts of Minnesota. In short, it has its historical significance. 100 years ago, this place was a hub of commerce and travel. Today, I joke about its future as perhaps the only ghost town east of the Rockies. I've lived here all my life and have seen the population remain static the whole time. I've witnessed firsthand the more rapid, heartbreaking phase of this city's deterioration. Through the photographs I've collected, I see that this was a city of incredible beauty, geographically and architecturally, from about 1800 until the late 40s. In recent years, the Chamber of Commerce has loudly bemoaned the dying downtown. Not ghettoized, just dying. As special as this place is to me, I feel it most likely not an isolated case to draw focus on the undeniable slow death of the city's downtown business section. The first thing one has to notice is because the huge shopping mall built across the river in mid-60s to the north of town, which sprang up like a mushroom, gobbling up acres and acres of prime farmland, pasture land, an effective arid gobbling up acres and acres of prime. If you have been to one of these, you've seen them all. So much for personality and local charm. Enter the big chains like Sears and out with local businesses. But the downtown is already in trouble before the mall was built. Why was that when no real competition as yet existed? I found the answer buried deep and out of sight in the dusty files of the Historical Society. Left alone for hours and days and weeks and months on end with photographic files unavailable to the public, I was able to totally familiarize myself with the changing face of the city over a period of a century and a half. We won't have the 500-year wait in the United States, as they had in Rome, for advanced decay to wipe everything out of beauty and value. At this rate, it'll be over with easily within 100 years. Racially, yes, of course, we're all familiar with the statistics on North America, but before we got into hot water, racially and genetically, we began to let our architecture slide. As in Egypt, Greece, and Rome, the architecture may be all that's left now. A very few poor, tumble-down wrecks as remainders of the glorious past. But I feel it was probably the same there as well. People stopped giving a damn, and wattle began to replace granite. Cheaper and easier, of course. You can drive down Main Street here and see a marvelous old edifice, a parking lot next to it, then a structure and an archaeological piece of crap next to that. And the latter, who are gaining ground all the time, the city, is at this point thoroughly bastardized architecturally. Nothing fits, there's no harmony, an occasional pet project of the Historical Society will stand out amidst the desolation, but I've seen these streets 100 years ago when every block in every direction was picture perfect, a fairy tale setting, a showplace, and I saw it all change. At first, still during the 19th century when the building was razed or others replaced, a bigger and truly better one went up in its place. Parking lots, of course, were unheard of. The time of the wonderful buildings stopped about the time of the First World War. Chillicothe was the site of one of the largest troop training centers in the United States. Camp Sherman was erected in 1917 in a matter of weeks just north of the city, across the river opposite the site of the mall I spoke of earlier. Contained over 3,000 well-constructed barracks, and then was almost totally eradicated by the end of the 20s. While it existed, it was bigger than the city itself. It seemed that no really decent buildings went up after that time, after the First World War. Things got static until the 40s and 50s, when destruction and demolition began to really take their toll. Fires and floods had their effect on original structures, which had been built to stand the centuries of renovation, and the creation of parking space took care of the rest. As for the rolling beauty of the outlying area, condominiums and other such ready-made slums, literally for welfare cases, not to mention superhighways and byways, have pushed out in all directions. As with the replacements for the great buildings of the 1800s inside the city, these condos have a serviceable lifespan of approximately 40 years. They are frail, ugly, and inhumane. Furthermore, as I've witnessed it up close quite a few times, the biggest effort when any modern contractor sets about the job of erecting one of these glorified huts is involved in the tearing down of the existing structure. The fact, terrible and terrifying, is that these modern engineers and laborers cannot themselves build the kind of buildings that they have such great difficulty in demolishing. For one, as we today as a nation are too poor to afford to erect such palaces. And worse, the craftsmanship and the materials are for it no longer exist. They don't make good bricks anymore. But the question I had centered upon was the mystification over the death of downtown. Also, in these thousands of photographs I've studied, we many interiors of various stores and shops of downtown. They resemble the insides of jewelry boxes, specialty shops, family-owned and operated, where people took pride, local industries producing furniture, automobiles, tires, canned goods, our own dairy, mill, and pottery, paper, the only one still remaining, and everything that was necessary to sustain the town and profit by export to other areas. The city was a major stop along the Ohio and Erie Canal from the 1830s until 1913. When the canal was finally destroyed by a flood. Today, Chillicothe is as dependent as any other area on trucking and so on for its basic needs. The marvelous shops were taken over by first one and then another succeeding business, remodeled, refurbished, until the effect was one of ugliness. Great tracts of floor were parceled and divided until the effort was that of a bunch of middle-aged shepherds squatting in the shadows of the pillars of the Pantheon or the Acropolis. That reminds me of my trip to Israel when I visited all these Roman remains. There's a lot of them over there. Beautiful. Still many of them standing tall. Roman columns and so forth. Just down the road is these shoddily erected strip malls in Israel, just like in the United States. It's sickening. But the question I had centered upon was the mystification over the death of downtown. Also, these thousands of photographs I've studied, we many interiors in various stores and shops. Four by eight panel and drop ceilings and exterior carpet. They couldn't keep up the old standards of decor and appearances so it appeared logical to chuck it all and go across the river into virgin territory and build afresh. This is precisely what Eisenhower had advised the Germans to do after the war. Abandon their cities, their culture, their heritage. Germans didn't take him up on it, but rebuild everything just as it was before, brick by brick. A classic example of how different people handle a lost war and a lost peace. What's the answer? It has to be a matter of bad values or no values at all to have allowed the situation like this to come about within 60 years. Note well, this took place years ahead of any of the more overt signs of racial deterioration. When one is no longer reminded of beauty and the worth and the order in what he sees around him, naturally he's going to think less of himself, what his mate should be, or his children should be, if indeed he bothers about children at all. Those without a past seldom worry about a future. A cartoon was reproduced in one movement periodical which I received depicting a mob of crazed liberals lynching a handgun while the actual robber himself walks away free and unmolested. This is an insight into the prevailing mentality. So it is with the issue of pollution. They go wild on the question of hazardous waste dumps, but are oblivious to the far greater danger of the hazardous genetic dumps, which are major U.S. cities. So what if we can manage over the next 100 years or so to clean up the vast amount of garbage and waste that the capitalist system has brought about, if over the same period we have degenerated into a bunch of low-level savages, a human garbage dump with no chance of reclamation? It is a cornerstone of the National Socialist outlook, and a hard one at that, which so few can manage to grasp, that no matter what, if the blood is preserved pure, it can survive and overcome anything. If atomic warfare destroyed all human life on Earth but two Aryan specimens somewhere in New Zealand, we would begin again. There is no threat greater than that of genetic pollution facing life on the planet. That is one and only thing that could conceivably erase all civilization, all higher culture, and send this planet, as Hitler said, swirling back into the ether. It is an unnatural, peculiar human trait that allows so many otherwise intelligent people of our race to look upon inferiors as equals. It is something, a sickness, actually, that will most certainly die with the passing of this current age, and hopefully it will not take all the rest of us down with it. In line with the priority of blood kept pure and free of alien genes, when comparing the respective damage to be done by other forms of pollutants, I've often stated that the condition and content of these cities make it a positively attractive case for atomic warfare. After all, don't they employ radiation in the treatment of cancer? That, of course, is the far side of radicalism. It is, however, intended and offered in a 100% straight and sincere conviction of its inevitability. And so while we don't discount the prostitution and poisoning of the land, air, and water, we still view the defiling and befouling of the race as the worst possible corruption of nature's highest creation. Who was it that said, quote, if you would build a better society, build a better man? I'm not a sports fan in any form, but only a blind hermit could fail to be aware. And with regard to boxing, the blacks have gotten and kept the field pretty much to themselves now for several generations, mainly because Jewish managers and the Jews running the boxing trade. There are also a lot of black football superstars, as well as blacks in the past having been renowned for their ability to run like all hell. Is this then any case for racial equality or even black superiority? Don't make me gag. but millions evidently are content, even eager to think so. A comparison with regard to what goes on inside the ring, like a electric magnetic can opener, and take an old model squeeze and twist kind, and place both in a cement mixer. Turn on the mixer and let it go for half an hour. Remove both openers and see which is still working. The more primitive, of course. That's about as valid test as can openers as it is to human beings. The advanced brain and physique of the Aryan wasn't intended and didn't evolve to have the hell pummeled out of it for sport. But if you're going to pit a white man in the black in the ring, call it a match. Why not pit a black in the ring with a gorilla? Same logic, same kind of match. You know who'll win that every time. The more primitive, but takes an army of blacks versus an equal number of gorillas to see which side wins. The blacks, of course, because of their greater ability to organize themselves, take an army of whites versus an army of blacks, and the whites will win every time for the same reason. So who then is inferior? To attack a family of gorillas, which are some of nature's most shy and timid creatures, would be a gross immorality. To attack a village of primitive black Africans, replete with grass skirts and bones in their noses, would be equally unfair. But today, when confronted by armies of vicious black street criminals outfitted and trained in modern weaponry, and who are out to kill whitey, the bets are off. When they challenge the white man as a race, they must be answered as a race. And the answer in such challenge is a foregone conclusion. Therein lies the main fallacy of democracy, human rights, human dignity, racial equality, and all the rest of the system hogwash. Taking people one at a time, you'll get nowhere. In fact, you'll become hopelessly lost. There are plenty who'd say it isn't fair, but they overlook the concept of fairness was an invention and only exists in the mind of the Aryan. The third worlders and the internationalists know it's a joke. They are winning because they keep ourselves manacled on bounds of their own making. Ideas and customs intended solely for and amongst our own kind, not aliens. Commander Rockwell loved to repeat the prayer of non-whites, and early sicko Christians of the post-Roman world, when faced by or whenever contemplating our Viking ancestors, Lord, save us from the fury of the men from the north. This time, Lord, screw 'em. Well, that's it, reading from the great book Siege by James Mason, and we're going to get back to it as time goes on, because it's an in-depth, great book, straight-out revolutionary and so forth, and National Socialist. Think about it. And that's it for today, 14-5. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day. I know it's Wotan's Day. I checked it out. You know how I remember it? Today's Trash Day. Wotan's Day is the day after Trash Day.
Declaration of War, November 25th, 1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. We will simply swing you by the neck. This is war. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country.
television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader viewer was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During a shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead. After the fire, FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt for Matthews' followers.
In spite of Matthews' death and the arrests of his supporters, agitation persists for a militant, separate, Aryan nation. Quarter members say that the war has just begun.
Bob really won hell of a man. And imagine a man that would die for his beliefs or drink a man like that today.
Bruce Carroll Pierce was the FBI's most wanted man until his arrest. He was also the order's second in command.
Just because Bob died or we've had some deaths in the past or had some setbacks, I don't believe by any means that the movement is over or that our goals will not be accomplished.
The order was a secret army striking out at a federal government that was vulnerable to armed attack.
The government's weak. The government is pathetically weak. This government is so weak right now that if 5,000 men of any race, of any consequence, any type of philosophical fundamentalism stood up for the federal government, that we have 5,000 men who would die right now. Right now, what we believe in, the government can do nothing about it.
People are surprised at what's going on. And I think it's a situation you have to report. Guys like Matthews and others declared war on what they called the DOG, the Zionist Occupational Government. When that happened, you saw the Fed begin to scramble.
It was the robbery of a Brinks truck in Ukiah, California in July 1984, when the order made off with $3.6 million that drew the FBI's full attention. At the same time, Secret Service agents caught several members trying to pass counterfeit bills. After his arrest, a friend became a government informant.
I believe that those men are prisoners of war, and I would support them as prisoners of war.
Tom Metzger is one of the most popular leaders on the ultra-right. While media attention was fixed on the trial of order members in Seattle, from his home and headquarters in Fallbrook, California, an hour's drive from San Diego, Metzger continued to recruit for his organization, War.
This is a time of rapid communication, and we must be on the cutting edge of technology like anyone else. We like it because it reaches into maybe every home in the United States where there's a computer. Every young person that is into computers, and there are millions across the United States, and they tend to be sharp kids with these computers in their bedroom, and they can log on and get all this information.
To attract others to his program, Metzger also set up 24-hour telephone hotlines in 8 cities, including Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco.
Why are the Jews and their supporters so afraid of free speech if they try to terrorize their critics into silence?
Metzger also has a television talk show aired on Community Access Cable Television.
The reason that show dedicates it to free speech.
When FBI agents moved in on the order, members were within a few weeks of cracking Brink's Central Vault here in San Francisco. With more than $30 million, they could have bought and outfitted an army.
I need my own state. I need my own nation. I need to have my own schools for my daughter, for my son, for my family.
When Nero tried to persecute the Christians in the Roman times, it did not eradicate them. And I do not believe it will eradicate us.
Just a few will be enough to reignite the spark.